Hello and welcome to the Tacona Morning Drive podcast. This episode, I am joined by Ian Callum, who is an automotive car designer. He's a man who I've looked up to since I was very small, so this was a very proud moment for me to have him on the podcast. Anybody knows anything about my past will know that the Tacona name comes from the imaginary car company I created as a kid because I wanted to be a car designer. To sit down with a man who has lived that life was a real honour for me and a real moment of pride to be able to sit and hold a conversation with him without acting like an absolute child going, oh my God, you get to draw cars. Oh my God, you get to draw cars. So this was a really nice episode to record and Ian is a absolutely lovely guy. So on with the podcast.
I won't be professional then.
That's fine. I'm not professional either. I literally bumble around just chatting to people, and that's the whole idea behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all right. I have clicked record now. There's no intro, there's nothing like that.
You'll edit it, yeah?
No. This will be brilliant. Yeah, it's just a chat. But I'm just giving you forewarning in case you say something that you don't want anyone to know about. This is being recorded. And if you do say something like that, tell me and I'll have to do some editing. But the whole premise behind this is that it is a casual conversation, and the idea is to effectively demonstrate what conversation looks like, because what Tacona stands for is getting people to talk and to get people to just chat to one another to help make a difference. So
sure.
The idea is to kind of go, look how easy it is to talk, and here's an interesting, hopefully, conversation to demonstrate that. So that's it. Basically,
that's fine.
That's all you can expect from me is to go, let's have a chat.
Put my phone back on then.
Yeah, if that goes off, you can always pause. out the two of us, you are much busier. I literally was sat in my office this morning sorting out orders and not doing much else, whereas I've had to find an hour in your week to pop over. So for reference, I am joined today by Ian Callum. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And there's only one question that I have in any sort of structure, and that is, who are you and what do you do?
Oh, who am I? I ask that question myself every day. Who am I? especially getting later on in life, you really start to question who you are and what you've done and where you might be going. But as C.S. Lewis said, you're never too old to start a new adventure. So that's what I'm doing now, I suppose.
A new adventure.
So who am I? I am a car designer of 40 years professionally.
Yeah.
That means working for someone else or other clients. Before that, I went to various colleges. Before that, I was determined to be a car designer. I went through a fairly academic time at school. I went to the academy. It was all about the three R's, as we call them. Frustratingly so for me, because I was more interested in engineering and design than French and English.
Right.
But anyway, I got through all that. It was a means to an end, and eventually I went off and did industrial design in Glasgow, and I'm just going to turn
slightly so that it's not as both facing the same wall.
Yeah, okay. So, and then I went to the Royal College in London to study automotive design. So
amazing.
Then Ford. I went to Ford Motor Company for 11 years. Where I learned a lot. It was a little frustrating at times because the hierarchy in those days was quite established. If you're younger, you got small stuff to do. If you were older, you got the big stuff to do. And then I went to TWR in Oxford for 10 years. And then after that, I joined Jaguar 23 years ago now.
Wow.
And I retired 3 years ago.
And by retired, you mean you started working for yourself, really?
Well, I didn't know what to do. I knew I couldn't go off and, you know, take up gardening or anything. That wasn't going to be for me. So
so you did what most people do in their retirement and started an entire company that...
I set up with a few friends of mine who are fellow directors. It's not just me, there's four of us all together.
Yeah.
But David Fairbairn and I, David worked for me when I was at Jaguar, you know, we always had this idea that we perhaps when they start a business together, which eventually I waited until they retired before I could do it, because I felt a need to do the job that finish the job that I was doing at Jaguar, and that's what I wanted to do first. So at the age of 65, we started this business. Fortunately, David's much younger than me, so he's got a bit more energy.
Well, that gives you the freedom to do things like sit next to me with a sketchpad and chat about cars and drawing and all sorts of things.
I mean, part of the premise for me was that I would spend more time designing and less time running and worrying about the business, which is sort of ended up the way it is. But you know, we've still got a number of people to look after, and we still have, you know, people to pay and make sure we have the work coming in. So that's
probably quite difficult not to try and get involved when it's your name on the...
No, I try and forget about that fact. It's a convenient name. But it's a convenient name because people probably know it. But it's very much a joint venture with four directors. We've got an engineering boss. Dave is a kind of working MD. I'm the designer, and we've got a financial man.
That's a pretty good
balance.
Good split between everyone, really. Yeah. And I imagine it allows... people to kind of use their own strengths in the best way, doesn't it?
Mm. You know, and we do, and it had to be that way because I don't want to, I mean, I looked after, when I was at Jaguar, at any one point I'd be looking after maybe 300-400 people.
It's quite a lot, that.
It's, you do feel it, you feel the pressure of it, not so much towards your team, but making sure that the teams are doing the right things, you know, collectively.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of spreading out and people doing different things, you know, and a design team is quite an interesting group of people to look after. They can be a herd of cats sometimes, so you really try and make sure they're focused and
it's difficult with creatives, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's challenging.
Yeah, because
it's challenging, to say the least. But you know, I'm as guilty of that as anybody else.
Well, by nature, to be kind of creative, you're not necessarily walking the lines that are dictated to you, and you're not following set paths and fitting in boxes, really, are you?
No, but what people don't realise is that, you know, people, and I hate this this term that journalists use, you know, so-and-so penned the car. It's almost like you did a sketch of it and threw it over the wall and a bunch of very clever people made it happen. It's just nothing like that.
Yeah.
You come up with the ideas, you manipulate ideas, and hopefully as a director, my job was to try and direct to the ideas I wanted, I felt was correct for the brand. And then you work with it for 3, 4, 5 years until it comes to reality, and the designers or the design people involved are involved right through production.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'd be anything at any one time, anything up to maybe 300-400 people involved in that, not just in design, but everywhere else. So the policing of the project and turning it into reality is the biggest part. And I think if you look at successful designers in history, it probably wasn't because they were the most creative or... In fact, creative designers can be just a real pain, to be honest with you. But, you know, you've got to get people who can be creative within the boundaries of which you can work.
Yeah.
And that's quite demanding. And then you have to try and hold on to that creativity right through the process. And as a car is being developed, it probably has to go through hundreds of different processes and gateways and opinions and and attributes. You know, any car has anything up to about 200 absolute attributes that they have to meet, according to management. And you have to feed this car through all these.
It's amazing any cars ever get made.
Well, I often think that when I get to the end of it, I think, how did we manage that? Because when I think, you know, if I wrote a book about any one of them, you could write a whole book about how a car comes together and what's involved. A lot of people would disagree with this, but this is what I observed. If you were to... You've got a program director who will look after the big picture of budgets and how the car comes together and bringing the attributes together.
Yeah. That's okay. I'm sure that will not be too loud on the microphone, don't worry.
But, you know, at any given time in a car process, ask the designer.
Yeah.
They'll know They'll know where that part or that part of the car is in the process of it coming to reality, whether it be the even the cost of the part, what it's made of, who's making it, who's supplying it, you know, where it is in the time frame and all that. The designer will know.
Yeah.
And designers tend to have a much better picture of the bigger picture.
Well, because there's so much that they have to create.
Of course, you know, you're looking after the interior. You're responsible for every component you can see. And often a lot of the components you have to manage, you don't see, because if you don't manage them properly, you're not going to get what you want.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a simple example, for instance, we've specified 19-inch wheels on this car. And somewhere along the line, somebody will try and influence it to be smaller.
Yeah.
Inevitably, and you'll say, no, you can't. It's got to be this size of wheel. I know it brings challenges for you and unsprung weight and all that good stuff, but if you want a car of this size that you've dictated for other reasons, then you need to have wheels of this size.
Well, there's a lot of practical application for it as well, in like both directions, isn't there? And it's
absolutely
finding
yeah.
that balance yeah. between it looks right, but it fits the brakes and it doesn't yeah. force the ride to be too uncomfortable.
And so you have to be quite... You have to become quite a good politician at times.
I can imagine so.
And your own PR person as well, really. Try and make sure people do listen to you.
Like, it's you kind of sit within like the two realms of what it has to creatively work. So yeah. you have to manage that side. And then it also has to financially work and it has to practically work. And you kind of sit within the middle of all of these things pulling against how
yeah, the
comes
forces
out.
That are coming and going. I mean, designing a car, incredible. You know, we have all these attributes we have to attend to, and then you have to go and discuss them, challenge them, try and change them if you need to. You know, and often we would come up with a shape or a design, and to be honest with you, contrary to what everybody thinks, we get a brief. I don't know, most designers even see the brief. They know we're going to do another saloon car. Here's the length of it. Here's the wheelbase, and let's get going. You know, and you naturally know where your legislation is going to take you.
Yeah.
And out of experience. And then you get into the more subjective areas of, well, we want another 10 millimetres headroom. You say, well, that means it's going to change the exterior shape. So you go back and you challenge the structure of the car to see if you can get that 10 millimetres somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound very much, but when you look in the shape of a car, 10 millimetres in the modern car is quite a big difference, yeah. And people ask why cars all look the same. Well, we've got the same set of rules that we have to live by, whether they be cost, physics, legislation, manufacturing. They're all the same set of rules.
Well, now that things are a lot more like safety focused as well, that legislation is kind of dictating a lot of the sizes and shapes and materials that we can use, just because the headlight has to be X amount of millimetres off the floor and it has to...
It's a lot of that.
Curve and stuff.
Yeah, fortunately with new headlamp technology we can be a bit much slimmer and smaller and bring them down. But yeah, I mean, there's one that always used to catch us. It was unbelted occupant. There's a rule 208, I think it's called. It's the US rule, which says that at 30 or 35 mile an impact, the occupant's trajectory of their head cannot touch the header.
Right. Okay.
Anyway, and you can calculate the trajectory.
Yeah.
And it means that if you design the header too close, which in a lot of old cars probably wouldn't even pass it, you take an E-type somewhere, they wouldn't get anywhere near it, they would fail. So it's got to be a certain distance, which makes it a certain height. And you won't put more rake in the screen. It means you've got to make the car higher because you still got to meet that clearance.
Yeah.
And so on, and that's just one of many, many regulations.
Imagine you're very envious of the designers from like the 50s and the 60s that could have so much more freedom to be
they did.
Creative in the styling.
They did, but they didn't have the technology that we can put into cars. But no, I don't. People say, you know, I've actually spoken to race car designers or sports car designers who have done, or track car designers who say to me, how do you put up with all this? Well, you don't put up with it. It's just a fact of life.
Yeah.
You know, design is about taking all the facts and dealing with them. And if you can't do that, you're not a designer.
Yeah, I can
understand. I mean, a race car designer has to deal with aerodynamics, and he's not going to try and cheat physics in order to get something different. what I do is more subjective. It's not down to a set of facts. It is quite subjective, but you have to deal with the facts.
Yeah.
And I don't find that a problem. That's what design is about.
I guess it gives you some outer limitations as well, which helps to...
Huge.
...to go, right, we've fit
within. Then your challenge is to try and create something within those limitations, whether they be physics or whatever.
Yeah.
That looks at least a bit different from everybody else's.
Like I say, because a lot of cars these days, they're getting a little bit more kind of similar shaped blobs with four wheels and ridiculous ride heights and things. But a lot of manufacturers
have... called SUVs.
Yeah, they don't work for any sort of design language, apparently. They're very difficult to make look nice. And yeah. Funnily enough, just this morning I was reading the Road Rat magazine, issue number 10, if anyone's interested, and they were talking about design language and how an SUV effectively makes it almost impossible to design anything interesting because the proportions make it all a little bit too...
Yeah.
Like lumpy and bumpy, and yeah, I think the Rolls Cullinan was given as an example of
who was
the Rolls Royce Cullinan. No, their SUV.
Yeah, well, I challenge that, frankly.
Yeah.
No, I understand that. There'd be a lot of pressure to get the hard points, you know, the physical hard points into the corners that certain other parts of the business would expect you to meet.
Yeah.
What we did at Jaguar was challenge that. And somebody says you had to have a certain headroom and a certain tumble home and a certain trunk space and stuff like that. And you'd question, well, why? And come back with a good answer, then you have to kind of adhere to it. I think SUVs can look quite good. I like to think what we did at Jaguar was a bit sexier, perhaps, than the more squarish ones.
Well, it was definitely within Jaguar's design language as well.
Yeah, and, you know, the F-Pace was quite challenging to both Julian and myself because we'd never done an SUV before, for a start.
Yeah.
And the first ones we did, we kind of followed the rules of it. It was starting to look too much like a Volvo, to be honest. And so I said, well, we've got to get more curvaceousness into this and we're going to rake the back more so that, you know, we can get a bit more visual drama into it, which is what we did.
So did you take kind of the F-Type and go, how would we mould this into an SUV? Or did you, we're going to build an SUV?
Not really, no. I think that was pushing it too far. I think we just took our design language and tried and get some sculpture in it. Now, the problem with sculpture, of course, it takes up space.
Yeah.
And the moment you take up space, you're eating into that physical volume that the marketing guys must say you must have inside an SUV.
Yeah.
The reality is the trunk space in an SUV or the boot space is in that lower half.
Mm.
What happens above it is very seldom used. And if people want to put the seat down and fill the car to the roof, then yes, we're going to compromise your cubic volume in the back of the car because we've got a raked rear glass in it. But how many people really do fill their SUVs up to that height?
I can't imagine there's many.
So we just said, no, we're going to rake the screen forward, and rear screen, and we're going to get a little bit more drama. When I got to the I-Pace, that was a different...
That's a completely different type of car entirely, almost.
It is, but it had to be an SUV for a number of reasons. The marketing boys wanted an SUV, I think, it's because they probably felt they were easier to... Well, it was where the marketplace was, you know, and it still is. That's what people buy.
That's well, what saved Porsche, isn't it?
It saved Porsche, and it probably saved Jaguar as well. I mean, the F-Pace did a lot better than the saloon cars.
Mm.
E-Pace does better than the saloon cars, and likewise the I-Pace. I'm not sure where it is in sales, but it was a new sort of vehicle, and because we had a skateboard platform, we could change the proportions of it completely, which yeah. I was determined to do.
How did you find the I-Pace single series race event
I loved it. I thought they should do a road car. In fact, you know, when I was there, we were in design, we're pushing to do a road car version of that.
Makes a lot of sense.
And but I was told, unfortunately, we couldn't lower the suspension enough because of the way the car was designed, effectively as an SUV.
Yeah,
it would have meant there was no spring left in it, effectively. But I would have found ways around that. But anyway, it never happened. But I did push hard to try and get a road version.
It would have been a lot of fun, and it would have kind of precursored the Lamborghini, the SBR stuff.
Yeah.
It would have been kind of at the forefront of it, really.
And, you know, the power output could have been taken up a little bit, but it's got 400 horsepower already. It's probably enough for most people.
It's reasonably quick, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know how much a Tesla model, is it the X, the SUV one? I don't know how much the power equivalent of that is. The only thing I do know is that the fastest way to get an Alfa Romeo 4C through a quarter mile is to put it on a trailer and attach that trailer to a Tesla Model X. But it could have been a similar kind of thing, really.
You'll find the video. We raced our I-Pace against a Tesla.
All right. I should probably Google
S, I think it was. It was an S, and it was a big one. And if I remember rightly, we beat it.
Oh, I didn't even know that. And that should really be talked about a little bit.
So go and find a video first. There is a video of us racing the Tesla S. I think we beat it. Maybe it was just a Tesla, I don't know. Maybe it was just a Tesla. Yeah, the Tesla S. But, yeah. Oh. It's there somewhere.
They'll be on the YouTube somewhere. I'll probably find it after we finish chatting, to be fair.
As I said, don't quote me on it, but it's probably a bit late for that.
So you said that you had, been wanting to be a car designer since you were a kid. How did that kind of passion come about for you?
Yeah, I don't know. I just loved cars. I loved drawing. But I was drawing stuff before I kind of fell in love with cars, really. I used to, before school days, I was drawing all the time. Just stuff I saw around me. And it occurred to me these things must be designed in some way.
Someone's drawing them before.
Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know what clicked with me. But my grandfather always encouraged me in the car front. He liked cars. And, you know, my big game was to try and remember the names of all the cars and the various levels of trim and stuff on them, which was always quite amusing for everybody.
If you don't get these days, it's just...
Well, not unless you read the badge
or the
barcode that's stuck in the door somewhere. But,
yeah, it's not.
But
like,
yeah, I used to get the Hillman Deluxe, the Hillman Super Deluxe, and Hillman this and Hillman that. It was always, and every one of them had a different grille or a different detailing on it, and you could tell them apart. Marketing man's dream.
Yeah, you got eight different products, and all they are is a different bit of trim.
But so I just, at a very young age, I fell in love with cars. I started drawing them, and I thought, well, if you can design things, you must be able to design cars. And I must have seen maybe some one or two things on television where I saw probably a GM design studio somewhere in America where they were doing clay models and stuff like that. I vaguely remember seeing a magazine or a book with that stuff in it and thought, ah, okay, there's something going on somewhere.
Yeah, oh, that must be how it's done.
And then I looked, you know, I went to the library to find anything. I couldn't find anything in car design, my local library. But you just look out for these things, and it grew from there.
No, it makes a lot of sense that if the passion for drawing is there and then the passion for cars...
Yeah, it fell into place.
You kind of follow that passion and... To give a little bit of personal insight, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a car designer. That was my
life.
I'm not that good at drawing. I'm quite good at digital stuff because you can tweak digital stuff.
But my sketches now are not any more than things like this, you know. I work with the Helios modeler and I kind of direct him to the shapes I want. But I think it's important to be able to draw in order to communicate your ideas.
Mm. No, I understand what you mean by that.
But if you're a good Helios modeler or a CAD modeler, you can probably do them a different way.
Yeah, true.
I never used to believe that, but I believe it now because a lot of the guys coming out of college are so competent at 3D modelling that they can almost skip the sketching stage, except perhaps for their own use.
Well, there's people like, have you encountered Kaisel or the Kaisel?
Yeah.
That's all digital rendering and stuff like that.
So there are ways. I mean, I've met many. I know many architects, and you know, architects on the whole are people that fall into two categories, as far as I can see. Some who naturally could draw, and they tend to be good at drawing anything, and others that just use the drawing as a means to an end to build a CAD model. And of course, you know, up until fairly recently, that was just straight lines, really.
Yeah.
So it was always their ability to express themselves in CAD models probably came a lot sooner than car design, because until Hadida came along, of course, and she created these sculptured
forms. CAD design's come a long way now, hasn't it?
It's
not quite the same as the isometric paper on a screen that it used to be.
It's very good. I work with it all the time now. So
is that something that you've had to learn a lot more as you've...
No, I didn't need to. I have done Helios modelling in the past, and I've done rendering on Photoshop I still find, from my own point of communication, pencil and paper is still the easiest for me.
Yeah.
Because I've got people who can competently do that modelling stuff better than I can. But, you know, I grew up through my career with creating 3D drawings, full-size drawings, and then transporting them into clay models and giving direction. And if you understand that process in 3D, because it's all about sculpting at the end of the day, if you understand it, if you can think in 3D, you can give a good alias model, good modeler, good direction.
Yeah.
And if, you know, and that's all you really need to be able to do.
Well, yeah, because then you can, the you benefit know, with CAD is that you can tweak it as it starts.
The danger is that if you're turning your ideas, no matter how flippant or how unsophisticated your sketches might be, as long as you've got a strong idea, then you translate it into 3D in clay or through a CAD process.
Mm.
It's very easy to let that next process take over. And what you have to do is to bear in mind that you have this idea that you want to capture. And if you're not disciplined enough, you will let that sway and drift into another set of ideas.
Yeah.
I see it happening all the time. And, you know, I look at some clay models or cars in the street and I think, I'm sure nobody drew that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's just evolved because somebody was getting drawn into the clay model and they couldn't help themselves. They had to, you know, put a line in it and they formed it and the form became very exciting. And so they left it there, and what they should have done, or the director should have done, was say, take it off.
Yeah.
I know it's a nice line, but it doesn't need it.
It's one of those less is more things, isn't it?
That's my philosophy. It's not. It's about editing, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not about deliberately going out to create something of a minimal design. I don't mean it in that way. I mean, when you've got so many ideas in such a large form, then it's very easy to forget that this is a big piece of sculpture dealing with, but you have to deal it as if it's almost 20% the size. Because you don't see cars always close up. You see them 200 yards away.
Yeah.
And so you have to edit out the stuff that it doesn't really need.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And I think it's that purity of the right piece of design has... It would be ruined if you added anything extra, and it'd also be ruined if you took anything away.
Yeah,
like
that's
the balance that creates something that's pleasing to look at.
Yeah.
The stark contrast of that being like the Pontiac Aztec, which has so much going on and no creativity.
Well, yeah, somebody could argue that's very creative, but it's not under control, you know, it's not disciplined.
Yeah, no, that's another...
But, you know, I mean, it's like, I'm not saying anything's right or wrong, I have a point of view and it doesn't always agree with... what other people...
Yeah, well, in all fairness, your point of view has created some rather lovely-looking pieces of design.
Thank you.
It's not like we're sat...
They're holding out all right.
Yeah, it's not like you're the guy from the Aztec and I'm going, oh, that looks great. And you're like, oh, yeah, it's fantastic. You are the vanquished designer and you did quite a few very interesting cars. And every time I see an XF Estate, I'm like, oh, you know, Ian Callum designed that one. He follows me on Instagram.
I'm particularly pleased with the XF. Of course, it's not just me. I've got a team of people who do a lot of that stuff. But I do try and impose my philosophy on them all quite without compromise, I think, which is frustrating for individuals. But, the XF Estate, is quite. I see them on the road and especially if they're black with the 20-inch wheels, they look pretty cool, actually.
They're a very lovely car, and it's a real shame that they didn't do a full-blown, like, SVR spec.
Well, we did do, on the first model, we did do the RS.
Yeah.
Of which there are very few, by the way. I mean, not even 100.
So if you can find one, then it's...
So I saw one for sale recently. I think it went for about 40-plus thousand.
That's not that... high money for the
kind
of car.
No, but I think given that another 5 years, that'll be a very rare car.
Well, according to the man himself as well, like, if anyone listens that buys cars. So a friend of mine has a TWR XJS.
Oh, yeah.
Sat in his... he's got about 13 XJs, I think, at last count.
That's keen.
He's only 27, I think. It was my birthday the other week.
What models he got? All of them are just 300.
pick an XJS, he's probably got it.
XJS.
The 12s, the S, everything.
Well, the XJS, of course, yeah. The Walkinshaw racing ones.
And then he's got like a couple Jag of Daimler double sixes. He's the old Jag guy. He's younger than I am, but he's the old Jag guy.
Good for him.
He
Somebody's saving them then.
Yes, it's basically what he's getting known for as well, yeah. Which is hilarious because he's so young.
That's good.
But he has a TWR one, and I didn't know what TWR was.
Yeah.
Because I'm ignorant to most things in the world. And we have this running joke where he secretly wants to put V8s in all of his cars, even though he hates the idea and he loves Jaguar's lovely old V12. So yeah. I made a load of stickers for him that say Mr. Hellcrate, and I stuck them on all of these cars. It literally just went around his whole workshop and just stuck stickers on. And one of them's next to the TWR sticker because I was so scared to take anything or touch anything that I didn't want to ruin this lovely, lovely old Jaguar. I think it's a Chaucer one.
Right.
If that's the right pronunciation
of
it. But I didn't really know what TWR was. Could you explain it for?
TWR is Tom Walkinshaw Racing.
Right, okay.
And I worked for him for 10 years, and it was probably the best working 10 years I've ever had. He was a great boss. He was quite a... He had two sides to his character. He could get quite angry and forceful, but he always showed loyalty to me. And he kind of understood, being a designer, that I was needed the space to do what I needed to do, and he put a lot of trust in what I did. And so the first I left Ford, I was at Ford in Essex, and I was frustrating at not being able to get onto the big design stuff. So
yeah.
I thought, I'll take a chance with this TWR company. They raced Jaguars, they were born on for that. They raced Le Mans Jaguars and won.
Amazing.
On two occasions. Tom was looking for a designer to start a design studio, so I applied for it and got the job. I just finished at Ghia Carrozzeria in Italy, so I had a bit of a portfolio there that I could show what I was managing. And I said, well, what's in it for me? What's going to happen? He says, well, we could do anything. We could, anything you want to design, we'll try and design it. And he wanted to use design as a shop window. You know, it's,
right.
He had an engineering business which was flourishing, but he realised that if he didn't have a design department, he couldn't.
He got to show off how good it
is. Yeah, and he understood the value of that. So, but the short of it is, one of the first projects we got was DB7.
Oh, amazing.
And so, you know, at the tender age of 36 or whatever it was, I got to design an Aston Martin, which was really the start of my more visible
career.
Well,
you're still doing it now, really, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, that's what you're getting more known for in this space at the minute, isn't it?
So, yeah, I did a few Astons and then I went to Jaguar. But TWR... we did a lot of stuff there. Some of it people know, some of it people don't know.
What's probably the most well-known one from TV, aside from the Aston Martin?
Well, the Aston Martin, they did the Vanquish there as well, which started off called Project Vantage, which was actually a different car, but the same theme. I worked on the Rover 75 estate car, with Richard
right.
Woolley, you know.
I overtook a Rover 75 in my Renault yesterday.
Don't see many of them left, do you, but...
They weren't happy about being passed by a Renault 5 either.
It was a good car, actually, the 75. It was a shame BMW completely binned it, but there you go. That was politics at the time. What else? Did Ford Puma there.
Oh, amazing.
Did a lot of, we did it, funny enough, ironically, I did quite a bit of work for Ford as a consultant, just for odd projects that may or may not come to fruition. Most of them didn't, but they were kind of thrown into the fold.
He kind of leapfrogged up the ladder to where you were trying to get when you were...
Oh, totally, before. Yeah. Totally. And what else? Did the Nissan R390 Le Mans car.
Oh, right.
Because that had to be homologated as a road car, and the racing guys found that difficult to get their head round. So Tom said, well, you design the body for it. So we did. I don't know if you know that car, but it's quite a pretty thing.
It's another one that's getting on the Google list.
What else? I don't know. Volvo C70 we did with Peter Horbury.
Very
so
impressive.
So the C70 was designed in Oxfordshire, not Gothenburg. But I did work with Peter on that, and Peter was chief designer for Volvo, and he basically gave us a job. And of course, then TWR then built the car.
Really?
And yeah, they built it. They built the production.
Oh, wow. So all these cars that you think are made of in the Arctic
Circle. Well, no, we actually built it. Okay, so the Volvo was actually built in Sweden, and it was a mothballed factory, which was completely desolate, called Uddevalla. And TWR went in there, and they revamped the factory, and they got it up and running, and they built the C70 there.
Oh, so it was built in Sweden, but thanks to the TWR influence to get it back up and running.
We had an office there, and did a lot, because Tom raced the Volvos. Maybe he started off racing the 850 state car in the British Touring Car Championship.
Is that the white and blue one?
The Security Car one.
Which is a wild thing to have been in the touring cars, really.
Well, it was. It was a lovely story about that, yeah. But he said to me, he says, what's more aerodynamic, a saloon car or a estate? And I said, the estate cars are more aerodynamic. And he went, right, okay, we'll race estate cars then. There was no rules to say that we couldn't. And so we just went ahead and did it, and it worked. And then the British Touring Car Championship people said, we don't like this, we're going to have to change the rules, so it's got to be a saloon car.
What a shame.
And then it moved to saloon cars.
Some really interesting
races. I think they realised that the aero was probably an advantage. I don't know. I don't know why they did it. But
what does the extended roof act more of a wing than anything?
Yeah, the more you can chop the back off suddenly, the better it is, really. Mm.
This bloody road rat, I read that at the right time this morning. That had a bit about how, because they used to have those sweeping curves that would go almost down to nothing at the back.
Teardrops, yeah.
And it was kind of, with an automotive design, I think it said, like, it was actually better to kind of chop it off at the end.
Absolutely, yeah. And
in the early days of aerodynamics, that's what they were learning.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the E-Type, Malcolm Sayre designed the E-Type. He designed it sort of so the air would try and come together, but it needs to be very long. So the E-Type aerodynamically wasn't very good.
Mm. Which is why the McLaren speed tail has speed tail is all about
sweeping line. So rather than they came up with the cam tail, which cut the air off, and that's why if you look at a DB5, then you look at the DB6, it's got the big spoiler in the back that realised. And the reason the XJS was so square is because Malcolm Sayre realised that cutting the back off was more aerodynamically efficient than having a curved corner. Ironically, squarer cars are more aerodynamic than curved cars.
So my little Renault 5 out there,
it's probably quite good, actually.
Might be quite aerodynamic compared to my little curvy GT86 I've got.
Probably, yeah.
Which would be a wild thing
to
find out.
You've got a GT86, that's probably been designed with a lot of aero in mind more consciously, so they could develop a car much more accurately now as you follow the air through it, around it.
Well, one's from this generation, one's from nearly 40 years ago. Yeah. That was probably just designed to get as many people into it without taking up too much of the road.
It was a great piece of design, though.
Well, that's especially, praise.
It was just so honest. But the first one in particular was a lovely piece of layout, because it had the engine with the gearbox at the front, which made the wheels quite far forward. I think the one you've got has got a transverse engine.
Mine's the first year of the transverse.
Yeah. But I always wanted the first model Gordini, which was a fabulous car, but you can never find them.
So my friend with all the Jaguars, he went all the way up to Scotland to look at a first series Gordini, and then he went with his dad, and they opened the front, and his dad went, oh, this has been in a crash. And the guy's like, what? He's like, yeah, there's damage there. So they travelled all the way up with a trailer and came home empty-handed. But they have two 17 Gordinis that are believed to be two of the only ones in the country.
Yeah. They did rust very easily, unfortunately.
Which is probably why there's only two in the country.
Yeah.
But the original 5 was a lovely-looking thing. However, mine only cost £500, so I couldn't get anything more than what I've got for that.
I used to have one. I used to have a two-door.
I would have loved a two-door. I really like the shapes of the two doors. And you can do a little bit more with them.
Didn't know what happened to it. Sold it many years ago.
It's probably rusted away somewhere.
I think it was starting to go a bit even when I had it. So.
Well, we say mine is Paris spec. It's got a couple of dents and bits of trim missing and a couple of little rust spots coming through. So we just call it the Paris spec now.
Yeah.
So another kind of thing that a lot of people that aspire to get into car design don't realise is probably the amount of time that you spend in your early days designing boring bits that nobody appreciates.
Well, depends how you approach them. Every bit can be interesting, but my first days at Ford, I was designing steering wheels a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, which in itself is okay, but once you're onto steering wheel number 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, you get a little bit tired of them. And any Ford out of probably the 80s, there's a good chance I did the steering wheel on them. So
didn't they have those lovely three-spoke steering wheels back then?
Yeah, they did. I think I did a couple.
Yeah. They were actually quite nice-looking things.
They were.
They're the things that you engage with the most in the car.
And there was the XR steering wheels. I remember doing some of those. But no, most of the ones I did actually were more like they were obsessed with this idea of the four spokes with the big centre boss in the middle, and then they have the two and two.
Oh, yeah.
I think most of them were a bit like that. There was a three-spoke Sierra one I did, I remember. And then the airbags came in. I think I was the first person to design a European airbag.
That's pretty interesting.
It was, because this thing came in and said, this is an airbag, and we're all kind of looking at it with great nervousness, thinking it's going to go bang at any moment. And we managed to get deactivated. But the airbag was still left there. We deactivated it, obviously, but I was always rather... And then we designed around this module, and I think it went to the first one I did was a Granada Mercure.
Right.
So they had the Sierra Mercure, it was called the Mercure. It was based on the Sierra for XR4.
Right.
I think it was M-E-R-K-U-R. It was German for Mercury. And then I did the Scorpio Mercure, the Scorpio Granada for the American market. And it had to have an airbag. So I designed an airbag steering wheel for it. That was probably the first airbag steering wheel designed.
I didn't realise they went that far back.
Yeah.
You think of them as like a 90s to noughties innovation or anything?
This would be probably 86, maybe.
Pretty early.
But they were already there in the US. The US had airbags quite a while before.
It's surprising how much innovation happened in the US before it happened in Europe.
In terms of safety, yeah.
You're always thinking a bit behind, don't you?
Yeah.
Even stuff like sequential indicators. A friend of mine's got a 67 Thunderbird with them. And you wouldn't think of that
but
from
that
far back.
There's an interesting rule. You can't, if you see the sequential, you're talking about the sliders.
Well, these one, it was three individual lights that would turn on.
Yeah, that's legal. You can't, the ones you see in Europe are not legal in America.
Oh, right.
Because the rules are that the first indication of light must come on full.
Right, okay.
Rather than moving.
So you could have on, and then they go off sequentially.
And that's what Audi do in America.
Right.
To get over it.
To get past it, because it's like...
But you can't go on by a slider in America, so they have these different... I mean, they might change it one day, but... but yeah, so it's always challenging when we did lights. None of our sliders could go into the American spec car. And then Audi came up with the idea, we'll put it on and we'll slide it off.
Which seems so simple in hindsight.
It was quite clever. Yeah, you think about it.
If only we'd have had that idea.
Good thinking. So they're slightly different. But what else in America? Rear-mounted stop lamps. They came out in America first, the high-mounted stop lamps.
Which again seems like quite a simple innovation in that why don't we have a separate light to tell you when it's brakes and not just the light speed on?
Well, they used to have so many pile-ups on the motorways, especially in California, in the rain.
But if one of those cars is a Pinto,
and nobody knew that brakes were coming on, and they were just piling to each other. So, the Californians in the rain, not a good combination.
Well, they don't see enough of it to have
They don't see enough of it, exactly. When it does rain, it brings all the oil to the top, and the roads are just dreadful.
I rolled a Nissan Micra, thanks to that effect, once, in a woodland.
Really?
Yeah. It was a very grimy road after a lot of rain, and a very aggravated passenger that... caused a bit of chaos, and all of a sudden we're upside down. I heard an anecdote, or rather a story, from, I believe it was a car journalist, I'm not going to name names just in case it's not that accurate, about yourself and the DB9 and Mr. Fisker.
Oh.
And an interview or a press junket or something like that. And the anecdote that I heard was that you were there, obviously, with the XK. Fisker had taken over as DB9 final consultant, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And you were being interviewed. And then after the interview, they said, where are you going next? And they said to the DB9 to speak to Fisker. And your response, is what I'm told, is ask him about the nod to the DB5.
Yeah, that's true. True story.
Is that a true story?
Yeah, so because, you know, I'm not bothered people take credit for it, but, you know, I was responsible with the team, actually, funnily enough, in the Jaguar studio for creating the DB9, and the only thing Fisker did was change the tail lamps.
Right.
Credit. He did a nice job. It's fine. But then it was part of the Aston PR, of course, to make sure that it was their design, I designed it, which I fully understood. And then people said to me, well, I heard you did nothing to do with it. I said, well, I'll be honest with you, I did most of the car.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were sceptical and said, well, how can you prove it? So I don't really care.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to prove it. I know the truth.
Yeah,
people matter the truth. I said, oh, by the way, if you go and have a look at the DB9, ask them where the DB5 influence came from, and there's a line in the rear deck lid that came straight off the DB5.
Right.
So, and by all accounts, he didn't know about it.
Well, that's what I was told as well, is that they went over and said, oh, tell me about the DB5.
Henrik and I are fine. We're quite buddies, so it's not a problem. But and he was following the company, he was towing the company line. But
yeah.
The V8, on the other hand, slightly different story. I'd finished the V8, and then he took it over, and he changed it. Changed it a bit, but it's fine. But, you know,
I'm not trying to drag up old rivalries or anything.
No,
like
it's
that.
Fine. It's
more
get...
of that was a subtly clever.
I quite
way.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it was... I quite enjoyed it because I did know about it. I put the line in there deliberately to.
But I imagine it was just delicious to be able to have that little like aha, there we go.
Yeah, but you know, I'm so fortunate. I've done so many cars in my time that I don't really need to make claim to anything. That, you know, certainly I wouldn't make claim to anything I didn't do.
Yeah.
There's no point in that.
Yeah, you only stand to get caught out in that scenario.
And, you know, and when I picked up cars from other people, I would give them the credit for it. You know, I wouldn't, it's fine. It's okay.
No, it's quite an honest way to get through.
Yeah. It's not, I think you get some designers who love the accreditation, they love the idea of being noted for something, which is in itself a small pleasure. As long as it's good.
Yeah.
But to me, the joy is not that side of it. It's the creative process. It's the joy.
Mm.
You know, and I'd still get the same joy if people were to never see the car again.
Yeah. Like for me with design, so I obviously do bits because I make all my clothing. It's all, admittedly, I've got one of my most recent pieces that's going on a t-shirt, and I have to keep them very simple because of the limits of printing.
Sure.
But for me, I get to basically steal another car and then add my style to it. So that'll be on a t-shirt, blah, blah, blah. I find it therapeutic.
Well, enjoy the process, exactly. Yeah. And it is nice turning it into reality at the other end. And it's good to see them on the road and you know, I like when people say, I've got an XK. I've got it, actually. This comment I've had more from people with XKs, the aluminium XK that we did.
Is that the last one?
Yeah, 2006 onwards.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, I love it. It just gives me so much pleasure. And just look at it. I wash it and I look at it. And they say, thank you. Thank you for giving me such a beautiful car. I find that quite pleasurable, actually, that you've given something. It's a bit like writing a song, you know?
Yeah.
I played it at my wedding, sort of thing.
There's an old guy around the... So we've just moved house, and we've only been there a month. There's an old guy around the corner. He's got an XKRS and an XJ6 on the drive, and then an XJS convertible in the garage, along with about 15 old, like, 1901 motorbikes, stuff like that.
Oh, right.
He's got this Norton that's got a car engine, and it's driven by a CV joint. It's not belt driven or changed.
Shaft driven.
Yeah, so it's at like 45 degrees, so that it all fits.
Yeah.
But he's got an XKRS, and I obviously walked over and said hello when he was cleaning it. He's like, I just took this to Goodwood the other day, got 180 down the back straight, and the guy's about 85. I was like,
good for him.
Good on you, mate. Really impressive.
Good, yeah. Well, that would be pushing an XKRS, I think.
Especially tuned one.
Yeah.
It's running like 600 brake or something ridiculous.
Oh,
yeah.
Perfect.
Well, I don't know which model it is. I know it's not a Lister one. It's a different one.
Something different, yeah.
But, yeah, it's this absolute monster. And it's just this little old guy just bumbles around and then takes this little monster out at the weekend.
Good for him.
So I would be remiss to not ask how things are moving forward for you. Obviously, we've got the Cannon Vanquishers that we were both at Heveningham yesterday, and there was a very lovely example on the lawn.
Yeah, the red one, that's basically our kind of marketing car still running around. What's the future for us? We're doing an eclectic mix of things. You know, we've got a bit of furniture coming out. We've just done a whiskey, actually, bottle. We didn't do the whiskey, but we did the whiskey bottle.
I hope they sent you some, though.
And we've got some other different things coming out, not car stuff, over the next few months, which...
Because Callum is a design studio, isn't it? It's
yeah, not just the car, one of the reasons I did it is because I wanted to work on other things.
Yeah.
You know, I'd done 40 years of cars. I trained as an industrial designer. So I do have a passion for designing stuff that's not necessarily cars. And so we're moving forward. But having said that, we've got a couple of cars coming too for clients, which obviously I can't talk about. They tend to be of the electric mode. They tend to be of the kind of supercar mode. But
that's as much as we can.
Which is fine, which is good. But
I guess at that point, you're almost just rebodying a skateboard, really, aren't you?
Not always. Not with
the top
sports cars. If you're doing SUV, this is why these electric cars are running up so tall.
Mm.
Because you have got 50 millimetres of battery in the floor, which you, if you're doing a sports car, that's quite challenging.
Yeah.
And because you want to get your heel point as low to the ground as possible. And of course, people will argue there's less need for a sports car these days because you can make SUVs handle better than a lot of sports cars from a few years ago. So, you know, the emphasis has changed, but there are still those who want the ultimate shape of a sports car. But if you're doing something that's very low to the ground, you have to rethink the configuration of how it's built from electric cars.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, skateboards don't really work that well. The weight distribution is good, but the height just runs against you.
You're sat on top of it already.
Sat on top of it, yeah.
I guess with electric cars now, if you're going sports car route, you can really manipulate the battery technology to your advantage for weight distribution and shape.
Exactly,
and design,
yes, you can.
You don't have to just...
You can. You've got... And you can put your motors, obviously, between the wheels or even on the wheels.
Mm. You don't have to go... It's either the engine in the front or in the back. You can really play around with it.
And then but battery... Yes, you do try and place them, and a lot of batteries are placed where they can put them. Battery cooling is quite important.
Mm.
And if you place them wrong and you get the cooling on each one not exactly to the right constant level, they don't like that too much.
And they're notoriously easy to put out when they set on fire.
Well, we won't talk about that. Yeah, I think some of the policies just let it burn, I think, for some people.
I think I've seen is they put them in this big tank is effectively how they do it now. Just put it in a big tank.
Let's hope we don't see too much of that. I mean, the point is electric cars are coming.
Yeah.
They will be the mainstay of production in Europe, at least, by 2030. Yeah. I don't think anybody's seriously designing any new engines anymore.
No, they seem to be designing fuels. The thing, I think it was on Top Gear.
If they're doing fuels, then maybe the engine does have a future.
Mm.
But what's interesting is if you design a mechanic, if you drive a mechanical car and then you go into an electric car and then you go back again, the mechanical car doesn't... There's a lot of attributes the electric car has, the mechanical car just cannot have.
Yeah.
Without excessive amount of power.
Yeah, it's one of those where if you're going to continue with the mechanical car, you make them about the driving experience and not the speed.
You have to.
Because you can't compete with the speed.
You can hardly compete with the acceleration of an electric car unless you're really working very hard. Mm. You know, and I had an I-Pace for a year or so.
Well, I assumed that one that's out in the car park was yours.
No,
and
it's
you came and said hello, and you were in the lovely old 635, which I was ogling while I was not paying attention.
It's funny how many people notice that car. It seems to have caught a lot of attention, but
it's a lovely thing.
It's a very handsome car.
It's it's one of those where it's now kind of almost timeless, really, isn't it? It's coming to its maturity.
Yeah. Good design should.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think its successors will do as well in the beauty stakes.
Especially the kind of the mid-2006 series that they came out with. I think that one, that period of BMW design.
They all got rather bulky, didn't they?
Yeah, it's one of those that's a bit Marmite. And unless you see like an M5, you know that it's got the V10. I don't think if it had the V10, it probably wouldn't be as exciting as it is made out now. Because the shape before, it was arguably one of the best.
Yeah.
With the V8, like that was, for me personally, that was my favourite M5 anyway.
And
it kind of helped that they did those videos with Clive Owen where he was driving around and doing donuts and power slides, and I was about 8 when that happened, and it was the coolest thing ever. But that one that you've just got, and for anyone that wonders, Ian's got a classic BMW. It's one of those where you meet someone that's in the car world and you hope that they're interested in cars and they're not just interested in the car world. And to see that outside really is one of those, like, oh, yes, thank goodness for that.
I've had many BMWs, actually. And when I was at TWR, I drove BMWs. So I had 4 or 5 then.
Didn't have Jaguars. Hmm? I'm surprised it wasn't company policy.
At TWR?
Yeah.
No, so it wasn't. You could have any car. Well, in my position, I could have any car, any car I wanted out of Tom's dealerships.
Right.
And he had an eclectic mix of dealerships, thankfully. I wasn't allowed a Porsche, unfortunately.
Oh, how come? Too high up the
budget. Too high up the scale, I think. Yeah, so I was allowed a BMW. So I had 3 series BMWs, including an M3 at one point.
What shape M3 would that have been?
That was the after the 30.
The E36?
E36, yeah.
The fatter one.
Yeah.
Needed a bit more of a kick.
Yes.
But a friend of mine works for Mercedes Formula One team. In their engineering team, and he's like, the only company cars you're allowed are Mercedes, so they have to. And he's got like an SL500. He's like, it's boring and it's soft. He's like, he's got a Lotus Exige,
takes out on a Sunday morning.
We all need
a car like that.
Well, I've done the opposite thing, and I have a daily driver, which is the sports car, and my Sunday car has very quickly become a 40-year-old hatchback. But
that's fine.
It's brilliant. We took it to Heveningham, which is 2.5 hours from us. So we planned in a couple of stops.
We'd be.
And we weren't going to take it originally because it's the age that it is and it goes about 9 days before something breaks on it. My other half's very love and hate with this car because she loves the fact that it exists and she loves it when it works. She's petrified of it when it breaks down because she's never had an old car to live with or anything like that. And she's very much being dragged into the car world by me. And I said, right, we'll take the Renault. I've paid for the hotel, I've paid for everything. We're all right, we'll just take the Renault. Oh, what if something happens? I was like, well, then it's part of the weekend. Something happens, we figure it out. We're not a million miles from home and blah, blah, blah. And that trip was so much more fun because we didn't have Bluetooth, we didn't have our phones plugged in. One of the window mechanisms is broken, so that window is wedged in place. We had Radio 2 on the whole way because it was the only station that was consistent. And we were singing and dancing and laughing and just it made...
Back to simplicity.
Yeah, it just made the whole weekend.
Yeah.
And we stayed in like a little... It wasn't a log cabin. It was more like a shepherd's hut kind of thing. So we had no Wi-Fi and no internet.
That's better
and
that way.
The site that we stayed on had 8-week-old baby goats.
Right.
And the guy who ran it happened to see us looking at them. He's like, oh, would you like to come and feed them with me? So we fed these baby goats, and I've got a photo of one stood on the bonnet of the Renault.
Welcome to Suffolk life.
Yeah, and it was just good. The simplicity of the whole thing is so refreshing compared to how things are these days. Like, she got me this little Casio watch for my birthday, and I've been an Apple Watch guy for like 5 years. And it's so refreshing to have a disconnect from the world.
I think there's a move towards a simpler life, you know. I think it's all become too...
I don't know
too
if it's because I'm getting closer to 30 or whether it's actually
wait till you get closer to 70 and then you'll think twice about it.
Nice to have some simplicity, and it's nice to see that you still wander around with a sketchpad and a pencil, and it's not an iPad with a digital...
No, I do use an iPad. I use Procreate on an iPad.
Which I am...
Quite frequently, and I've
pushing my father-in-law to do because he's a graphic designer.
Right.
And he's still got the pad.
quite clever.
I'll send him this clip and then it'll force him to.
Okay. I put a matte surface on it, which makes it much nicer to use.
Oh, fantastic. Aren't you?
Yeah, it's got that film on it. It feels like a paper texture.
Oh,
so, yeah, I use that if I'm in a plane or something. I'll just get out and use that. I'm not brilliant at it, but I can get down my ideas on it. So,
which is the point, really?
Which is the whole point. Yeah.
Well, I've had you for an hour, and I appreciate that you are very busy.
I've got a few things waiting for me. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to end things there and say thank you so much. And where would the best place be to keep tabs on all things Callum? Not necessarily just yourself.
Well, we've got a website.
Yeah.
And it's called Callum Designs. I think. I should know, shouldn't I?
It's probably not the part that you made. He's opened his phone and Auto Trader is the first thing that pops up.
Oh, no. Look what I found. I found an XJ.
Is that the... Oh, it wasn't the XF.
575. Oh, no, it's not come up.
That's all right. We'll go with Callum Designs. Yeah.
.co.uk. No, .com, sorry.
Oh, you got the .com.
I think there's a hyphen in there somewhere.
I'll be sharing a link anyway, that's okay.
Yeah. Okay.
That'll be the best place to see what's going on and see the whiskey bottles that you've made, hopefully.
Yeah, that'll be in there and, you know.
And obviously the Vanquish is on there.
The Vanquish is on there and there's a few other things that... I discovered this on the website.
That is lovely. Is that in satin?
It's not actually, no. It looks like, I think it's just a light.
Is that an XJ?
This looks satin, doesn't it?
XJ 575R.
575, my favourite one.
There we go. So if you've got one of those...
Very rare. Yeah. Almost as rare as XFRS's. XFRS estate cars.
I'm going to stop the recording there before we just sit and look at piston heads.